And then there would be exercises held in which the troops would be sent in to try to rescue people who were closer to the ground zero of a nuclear burst. This training went on both in the militia, and the militia got quite a boost out of this, I believe, because first of all, it needed more men and fairly simple training, and good training for anybody. First aid was very much stressed then, and but it was a very difficult activity to organize, because it involved, of course, civilian organizations. People didn't like, generally, the public were uncomfortable with such kinds of exercises. They fell into, I think, disfavor, and they were costly in that they involved a lot of people and movement of personnel in vehicles.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. What was the public opinion of all this? Like today, even the word civil defense can get people very hostile. Just wondering.
About the same.
Yeah.
About the same. People haven't changed really at all, even with the passing of time. And I would say, no, I amend that statement. I think people have become more adamant in their their feelings that there must not be a nuclear conflict. Mm-hmm. I don't think that anybody in the past wanted one. I'm not trying to give that impression, not at all. But I think that the technology has changed a lot since 63, 66. And I would say that it was something that was really, people didn't know very much about Nagasaki and Hiroshima. Yes, they'd seen pictures and so on. And but they, people didn't want to hear about it any more than they did now. But I think now you've got a different public relation set up here with organizations who, whether they are well informed or not, or the degree to which they are well informed, are making sure the issue is kept alive. And I wish them well. No one wishes to see this world contaminated.
Well, they can do it. More power to them.
Yeah. But it has to be done. Well, I shouldn't say that. I don't know how we're going to sort this thing out, but it's a political problem of a great magnitude, and it relates to, I think the main problem is the Russian psychology as compared to the American psychology, and there's a vast difference in their experience. The United States went through a terrible war in the Civil War, a little bit of a war in the Independence War, but aside from that, which is a long time ago and was using conventional weapons, they've never had been laid waste like the Russians. And I, having seen Britain and Italy and Holland, but particularly Britain, I would say that you have to go through as a civilian, the civilian horror of war, and then multiply it 1,000 times for nuclear war, and you realize the feeling people have. I don't know what the Russians are doing entirely. I do know that they have a fallout program, of a fairly fallout shelter program of a fairly massive nature, but I don't know how effective it is. You can have, as I say, lots of plans, but if you don't have them set up and people set up ready to take over, and that in large numbers, so that if there are casualties, there's always going to be somebody alive to handle things.
Well, how effective would ours have been if it had come right down to a really major case of fallout? Well,
very ineffective.
Yeah.
Because there was no real stalking Even putting signs on buildings was done very little, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You will see this in the States, and you have the sort of the looks like a propeller,
mm-hmm.
and it says this is a fallout shelter for so many people. But I would question even the validity of their fallout program. It's been grossly underfunded, if you really want to be serious about it.
What would the procedure have been, say, if it had actually happened that one day the warning lights would have gone off and there had been a major Russian attack? What was the procedure then as far as your office was concerned?
Well, this did occur in, I've forgotten the year, was it 62, the Cuban Missile Crisis?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
When we were on the office, the general's office, which included himself and myself and his, I believe, his staff sergeant, and we were destined to go to the CARP bunker, the Diefenbunker, as it was called. I had one morning, it looked so bad, I took my shaving kit and a change of underwear and a cup of, in a club bag, and advised my wife and children to stay put, and if things got worse, fill everything they could with water, and move the food downstairs, and stay in the basement. It's the only thing I could tell them, and this was very inadequate protection. There was an alert of all the army units in Camp Petawawa, for example, Valcarce, anywhere, and they moved some troops to where they could more readily get into a city to help. But I think this applied across the country. The provincial governments were alerted to the be prepared to move your selected personnel into your particular hole in the ground. The signals people were put on full standby, all leaves canceled, and people returned to man the sets and so on. That's about all you can do, is cross your fingers. As it turned out, our finger crossing worked, or Kennedy worked for once. I'm not a Kennedy fan, but I think that's one time he did the right thing in standing up to the Russians. But and Reagan now is trying to do the same. I don't know if he hasn't got quite the same problem.
The Russians, their own and foreign policy mentality seems to have changed somewhat over the years as well.
Oh, I'm sure it has, yeah. But you still have, as we have, a lot of World War II men still in charge, and very much so in the Russian government.
Mm-hmm.
That was a very interesting period. It included a trip with our traveling circus down to the Pentagon, and we put on our display, and the general gave his talk to groups of the staff leaders in the three forces down in the States. That was very interesting, getting the equipment set up, and I walked in with a camera on my Sam Brown belts, and I wasn't supposed to have any camera at all, and they just assumed it was part of my uniform. But I hadn't done this intentionally. It wasn't discovered until I stopped to take a picture of a cherry tree in the middle of the courtyard of the Pentagon, as we were had a gang of laborers taking this big board and equipment out, and the fellow who was with me just about had a brick right there. He said nothing and I said nothing. We hadn't seen many cherry trees in blossom in Ottawa at that time of the year. We also went out to NORAD headquarters in Deer. It's now dug into the side of a mountain in, was it Denver?
Oh, near Denver. The American one, yeah.
Yeah.
I can't remember.
Yeah.
Colorado Springs?
Colorado Springs, that's right. It's in, now in some Red Horse Mountain or something. Mm-hmm. And we also stopped off at SAC headquarters and had a complete tour of both. So those were chilling experiences to me. Tremendously expensive communication facilities there. Every sort of facility, every way of communicating practically, except smoke signals, seemed to be being used with teletypes and TV monitors all over the place and guards and people standing by with scopes going around watching. It was then all aircraft activity. And I realized why it was a good thing to invest in IT&T and other communication companies. And I just hope that it's not some of their influences that's keeping this whole pot boiling. But it was a scary experience, as though we were waiting for the apocalypse to commence.
And I was just thinking, you must have felt sometimes like studying it and looking at it for so long, you must have felt as though it was inevitable. Or did you find that you got used to this after a while?
Well, first of all, it like everything else with the human, I think you do get. It's not case hardened. You get to accept certain things as possibilities, but they were never popular ideas. And when they go through SAC and through NORAD headquarters, it was scary to see the extent to which the Americans had gone to be ready to strike in the event that the Russians struck. And it was an experience I'll never forget.
In Ottawa at that time, what was the sort of government attitude, well, both in the case of the government and in the case of the Army General Staff, to defense measures like this? Were they pressing for more all the time, or was it starting to slacken off?
Well, I would say that the Army was a bit fed up with it, to be honest, because it was very un-Army-like. You had to do a lot of things with a lot of people in civilian activities, civilian police, mayors of towns and cities, and provincial officials. And it was a type of activity that a lot of the soldiers then had not bargained on when they had not thought they would come into contact. But I found it interesting because you ran into all sorts of attitudes, some of which were outright just trying to make the best of getting empire building and so on. Attitude of the government? Well, you know that at that time Diefenbaker refused to put nuclear tips in the Bomarc missiles. That gives you a good idea of an attitude which perhaps was the right one. Perhaps we should have gone all the way along, including our NATO forces, if we wanted to be Simon Pure. The Americans, of course, were paying for much of the cost of the defensive part. I went to a couple of cabinet committee on defense meetings, and I was appalled at the ignorance and the lack of attention of some of the members, and they were all senior members of the government, I mean, they're all Privy Council people, concerning the matter, and how they were politicking over it. Like, why couldn't they get this in their riding? Because, you know, why should it go to somewhere where it should go for practical reasons from a military, rather? But it sort of disgusted me with some of the comments. Some of them were very good. I won't name names because I forgot. It's probably just as well.
Yeah.
But the government was not able to really handle it any more than the general public, I don't think. But they did at least allow the forces to set up this organization with the General Rinch at the head, and for the planning to go ahead to set up a civil defense training college in Ironbriar, set up emergency measures organization, which exists to this day. I would say they tried, but it was a task which really was more than I think the government was up to at the time, and I don't know what government has really, maybe a government like the Swiss would have taken the bit between the teeth and have provided practical fallout shelters, and they're very concerned, as I'm sure they would not be a combatant, but they would certainly have the fallout.
Just one more thing before we go on to something else, and just, what did you feel that the probability was that Canada would come under direct attack, and how severe an attack?
Well, I don't think that Canada's targets were considered to be all that important in view of the number of American targets of much greater importance. But the problem is that not every artillery shot hits the target,
mm-hmm.
and nor would every bomb hit the target. And in today's war, nor would every missile hit
mm-hmm.
the target, regardless. Well, look what happened to the last two attempts to put communication
yeah.
satellites in their proper orbit.
That's the good example, yeah.
There's $170 million each
mm-hmm.
Shot into nothing. And the same thing can happen with everything from pistol shot to a missile.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, if there was a shortfall, that meant it was in Canada. Or if you had to, for some reason, abort a mission, in those days it was aircraft, then they would certainly not going to fly back to Russia with their bomb.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would drop it somewhere over anywhere in Canada. You try to make it a profitable drop. That's the common
yeah.
usage of ammunition. But then, of course, there's the fallout side. It was the result of us living in a narrow strip across the American border. And a lot of their, because they wanted to push their defenses as far north, bearing in mind we're now talking about polar route
mm-hmm.
flying by aircraft, then a lot of their major defensive and offensive areas were stationed along their northern border,
mm-hmm.
or therefore close to our major centers of population.
Did you assume that places such as Toronto, Montreal, Hamilton, and so on would be hit, or were you just still working on it?
Montreal and Toronto were considered... that was another study that went on, was the probability of our targets being desirable targets.
Mm-hmm.
And some of our major cities, and Vancouver was one of them, from a point of view of disruption of war effort and terrorization of people, were more profitable targets than some American cities. Could I just...
Sure.
A minute?
Just for sort of local interest, with Victoria's harbor and port and then naval base and so on, was it suspected as a target?
It was considered a good secondary target.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think things have changed now. I would expect that our pork and that peanuts were probably a third or fourth level target now, subject always to an emission being aborted,
mm-hmm.
and you use up your missile on this place. It's still a worthwhile target from a point of view of effect on civilian population.
We'd be more suffering more, you think, both then and now from fallout from attacks in the Seattle area, though.
Yes, but you're fairly fortunate being west of Seattle, and the westerly winds, just like the fallout from St. Helens, I don't think much was, if any, came here.
I don't recall hearing any. No. That's true. That's interesting.
But that is only the 90% possibility. There's probably a 15% possibility that you get a very heavy fallout here. It just depends on the vagaries of the wind. They look for, at least we thought that an enemy would look for military targets first, because you can't survive if you can be destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, for population centers where there were industry and where there was government centers were controlling activities. But we fit into really more the government side population center on a smaller level.
Certainly not just Guaymolder work point to be major.
No. We think they look pretty big, but really they're peanuts.
Okay, so you were there for what, 3 years?
3 years, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Then as a reward for hard, diligent, loyal work under somewhat trying times at times, I managed to get a posting to London, England. And one of the major reasons why I got the posting is because I had, since my various postings in Quebec province, I had become officially bilingual,
mm-hmm.
and French being the alternate NATO language, I was able to get a post to the Army Board Secretariat of the Military Agency for Standardization, which you'll find on
the... You were posted there in 63.
Yes.
So
I was there from 63 to 66.
Yeah. You were in Ottawa from 60 to 63.
Yes.
Okay.
At this time I was... I was by now a major.
Mm-hmm.
This was a job in which I was paid by the Canadian government. The movement of my family, the storage of my effects in Ottawa, and was paid for by the Canadian forces. But my activities were completely international. I was known as an international staff officer. We were involved in an organization which consisted of an air, army, and naval boards for standardization of equipment and of procedures. In the army board, I might say that while I was there, it was commanded by a Dutch general and a Greek general, I mean, at different times. And in the Army Board, practically the entire time I was there, I was under a Turkish full colonel. Then the Secretariat was headed by a lieutenant colonel who was British, a long-standing friend of ours. Since then, and was made up of majors. At one time there were two Canadians, one American, one French. I think that was it. And we had, each of us had a staff sergeant. Mine was a British staff sergeant. And then there was, within the building, within the organization generally, to support the three boards, there was a translation group of very highly qualified translators and people who could go to a conference and translate in the actual period of a conference. There's a different skill between sitting down with a piece of paper and translating it.
Yeah.
And we had a group of ladies in the typing pool who were from a variety of nations, and they had to be able to do either English or French fluently, and they had to know the other language adequately so they knew what they were doing, you know. But my activities encompassed, had one, what they called the Army Equipment Working Party, and then each one of these working parties or panels of experts was headed up by usually a colonel or a full colonel or a lieutenant colonel from one of the nations of NATO participating in that field. And they would rotate from time to time. It would depend. Sometimes a particular nation was very interested in one subject, and they would like to provide the chairman for that panel.
Was there a lot of that? Different countries with an aspect of it?
Oh yes, there are some countries. Well, for instance, Portugal was very small in its activity. It used to send representatives to the Army Board, and it would take part in a number of the panels. They were interested in clothing problems. That was came under the Army Equipment Working Party. That was an interesting study where they tried to standardize sizing systems for clothing and for footwear and for headgear as well. And the reason for this has to do with nuclear fallout because of the contamination or bacteriological chemical warfare in which you have to get rid of the clothes that you've got on. Well, it could well be that a Dutch unit might be closer to a Canadian supply element or British to a German and so on. And we found that, first of all, that the people within the various nations were different. The Portuguese, you might say, were one of the most ethnically pure groups. They tended to have very broad feet, big broad feet, and a large head as compared to North Americans or British.
Mm-hmm.
The British had big feet, wide and long. The Americans and Canadians tended to have long, narrower feet. And that's one side of the problem. Another side of the problem was that the sizing systems were different. For instance, in measuring the length of a sleeve, some would measure from under the armpit down to the thumb joint. Others would measure from the top of the shoulder, shoulder bone there, down to the same thumb joint. Or others would go from the back of the neck and down the arm. And then, of course, there was the sizing systems and shoes. There's the metric system, and there's the British-Canadian-American system. And the British-Canadian-American system varies one to the other. This size 10 shoe made by those three countries are three different sizes.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a very interesting, and this is the one area that had very definite economic advantages possible if countries could sell to each other, and you knew when you bought a shirt size something or other that was the same size as you were used to. It would facilitate trade. There was the standardization of equipment as much as possible. The soldiers' submachine gun type weapon was one of the ones that they really tried to go after.
Did that go through when you were remember?
Well, it had already been developed, and the FN rifle was the main product that came from that. But and the standard round, what 3.97 millimeter round, was the one which all countries who were using that had developed a round which almost always would fit the other one's weapon.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is in that if you get different countries on different standards of measurement, as we were then and still are, imperial and metric, your different industrial systems in setting up tools, the tooling devices, you just don't come out with identical sizing. It's a very difficult problem, and it's highly acute in weapons that your rounds fit, so they don't jam, so they don't explode in your barrel, or so that they will, in other words, fire and hit where they're supposed to hit. In fact, because of my wartime experience in the armor, in which I had fired thousands of high explosive and machine gun rounds, or had directed their fire, when I was given the job first, they had a book called the Broadfields. That was the Broadfields of Army Equipment. It's a nice British type term.
Mm-hmm.
And it was known as I was the Broadfields officer. And I'm happy to say I was the last one, because when I started looking at what my predecessors had done in all good faith, they were listing types of weapons that various organizations had and various equipments, but there was only this one single round that had ever been test fired, and everything else was measurements were about the same and so on. And I was allowed to speak. I wasn't a member, but they respected what I said, and I said that I would not like to be in a tank and take a round made in Germany of a 155 millimeter and put it in the breech and stay in the tank to see whether it would explode in the gun or operate properly unless this had all been done and proven satisfactorily prior to my getting in the tank. And the same with artillery pieces. And even the same with a small arms weapon can kill you if it blows up, you know. And when that was discussed, they all went back to their countries, and they then, I guess, for the first time took a serious look at what we were putting in this book. It's considerable expense to NATO.
Mm-hmm.
And they all came back and unanimously decided to drop the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they retained the studies they had done so far on that one round, and they encouraged the same thing happening in others, but it's a long way from being standardized.
Yeah.
But they standardized where they could. For example, the phonetic alphabet was standardized by that organization. You know, the Alpha Baker,
mm-hmm.
Charlie Dog, and so on. Then we had one panel of experts, and the man in charge of that was a full colonel from Bourges in France, in the French School of Pyrotechnic and something or other. And this had to do with the standardization of fuses and explosive, the devices related to setting demolition explosives. And the reason for that is that throughout all of Europe, the major bridges are prepared for demolition. There are no charges in place, but it's all set up, it's wired. And the important thing is that if a bridge is here and it's being prepared by a Canadian or a German engineer or a Dutch or whatever, you're not sure when it, the time comes that you have to blow up the bridge, that it's going to be a Dutch or Canadian or German element that has the same kind of material. And if a fuse won't fit in correctly, or the detonator for the fuse, and if the fuse won't fit your charges, you're in big trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Plastic charges have helped a lot on this, but that was one of the practical things that was going on, one of the panels in which I was involved. We used to hold most of our meetings in London, but and that was for a matter of saving expense, because you had your staff was set up there for translation and for interpretation. You had your conference rooms, no extra charges involved, and so on. But every once a year, at least, a country would be persuaded to host the group for a particular study. So we met in various times in Florence, Rome, where the Army Equipment Working Party met, and we met in Koblenz. We had a large exposition of German army equipment. Remember, we're still talking straight army now.
Mm-hmm.
And we met in Heidelberg once. And I think that was about it. I was there 3 years. But it was a marvelous personal experience to work for the first time in a truly, completely international milieu.
Did that work well with the various nationalities?
The nationalities were surprisingly cooperative. There's a degree of standardization in the training of officers in all countries all countries of the same Western standard, we'll say, that at least you sort of know how to approach people. So there was, it's not like a group of businessmen in a way, I guess. They have a different challenge there to meet,
yeah.
Because you don't know the background and training and experience of the other person, but you can guess it in the military, and it's fairly apparent.
Well, what would be the arguments against standardization, against, say, everyone adopting the 40mm Oticon anti-aircraft gun, or everybody adopting the Panavia Tornado fighter plane? What would the arguments be used against that?
Well, one of them is obvious, and that is the industrial national interest. If you have a plant that is producing a plane, and you think it's a pretty good plane, you want the others to adopt that one, and then you sell the patents, and you will benefit most from it. There was pure greed involved in industrial ambition on a national level. There's the practical side, which I've already mentioned, over the different engineering philosophies, techniques, and tools that make it extremely difficult to be that precise with electronic type and ammunition and weapons and so on. Pride, national pride comes into it. You've got the Europeans versus North America. You've got the British feeling sometimes they're superior to them all, and sometimes they were. And I think that there are practical reasons and there are nationalistic and industrial reasons why it's very difficult to achieve real 100% standardization. You get people who generally disagree, and the Americans disagreed with the FN.
Mm-hmm.
They developed their own weapon. They thought it was a better weapon. I wasn't able to follow that argument to see. And they went ahead and made their own weapon, had different kind of round, a lighter round. And I have a feeling that it was disproved in the Vietnam War.
There was a lot of complaint about that
yeah.
weapon in Vietnam, yeah. Congressional committee set up to investigate
yeah.
it, and they said nothing changed from it.
When you hit a man, you want him to stay down. And it has to be a fair, there has to be enough shocking power in the slug to do that. And there, that was the argument of the member against that American weapon, but the Americans went ahead regardless. And I'm not sure that Remington Rand or whoever was, I don't know, whoever was involved in manufacturing
the
thing,
yeah, that's one of them.
Didn't pressure, bribe, or whatever else the people who were able to make a decision.
Well, it was a tremendous debate in Congress, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
Came through them.
Yeah.
Tremendous fight over it.
Yeah.
What were some of the Canadian interests in standardization at this point? What were some of the things they wanted to see done?
I don't know exactly what. We, of course, were interested in armored vehicles, and that was beyond the purview of our activity, and some of the things like scout cars, tanks, and things that we were incapable of producing ourselves at because of the cost.
Mm-hmm.
So we were glad to have the British and Germans and so on standardize on, say, the Leopard tank, and we then bought our share of them, just as we're doing with the aircraft. It's such an expensive research and development and production cost.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's happening in Europe now too, mm-hmm. I guess, with the Tornado plane. Yeah.
We went, the Canadians were pushed things like Arctic clothing and equipment. We were considered to be up on that. We had a good voice in communications arguments, I believe. Clothing items, we were in there with the rest of them, though we didn't have the productive capabilities. We had done a fair amount of research. We were sort of peripheral equipment people, and we tried to influence the other nations with our ideas on the main equipment, like tanks and planes. But our voice was, I think, pretty small in the total argument. But that was a very, very interesting, I think it was the highlight of my career from a point of view of interest. So in 66 I finished my 3 years there, and I returned to Ottawa as a lieutenant colonel. And I was promoted and posted to do cataloging work in Rockcliffe under materiel command, because I was considered an expert, which made me smile. And part of that was because of the Broadfield business, which I helped to cancel. I was there in that job for about 3 months when base administration officer at Canadian Forces Base Montreal quit, and I was shot down there because I was bilingual and I knew Montreal from my previous postings. And I wasn't there long when I found out why he quit. There was no standardization of our administrative instructions, because every force had their own and you could use whichever one was suitable. I had a sad experience of a good friend who was base commander die in the job, or on the job, of a tumor of the brain, and it was a sad experience before he actually died. The deception of his medical condition, and the disbelief when I would tell the general, or it was actually the admiral. Then we worked through Expo 67 and the centennial year activities in support of that. Very interesting and very active thing. I can see the forces having the same kind of a problem here in 86 with visiting ships, arranging laundry, security, hitching up telephones to the ship to shore, transportation, amusement for the crews, security measures all over the place. And remember, this time wasn't so far from letter bombs and in the post boxes in Quebec. And then after that,